relative. Like, it's still so impressive what they can do, and they've been so inspirational, I think, to so many other bands. You know, I listen to some bands now and you're like, oh, it sounds so much like The Cure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so they really created something purely defining for a generation, and I love them for that.
Fantastic. Natalie, thank you so much. You can hear the song in its full glory on Radio 6, Marianne Hobbs, on Thursday at noon.
The UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Justine Green. The government has warned that British nationals should leave Lebanon as soon as possible following significant escalation in the fighting between Israel and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Around 700 UK military personnel are being flown to Cyprus as part of contingency plans to support any evacuation. The Lebanese health minister, Firas Abiad, says 2 days of Israeli airstrikes have caused carnage across the country. He accused Israel of carrying out indiscriminate attacks with many civilians among the casualties. More than 560 people have been killed. Israel says a senior Hamas commander died in a targeted strike in Beirut. Our correspondent Oleg Girin is in southern Lebanon.
Israel itself said today Hezbollah managed to fire 300 rockets across the border, the very thing that Israel wanted to stop. This comes after everything that happened yesterday, 1,500 Israeli strikes, entire communities emptied out. The city of Tyre, where I'm speaking from tonight, is basically now a ghost town.
Sir Keir Starmer has promised national renewal in his first speech to the Labour Party conference as Prime Minister, but warned of tough choices ahead. He insisted that keeping a cool head during challenging times will be better in the long term than easy answers. Our Deputy Political Editor Vicky Young says Sir Keir is prepared to make unpopular decisions.
The Prime Minister was quite explicit about some of the trade-offs, as he called them, that people might expect. So, for example, if you want to lock up more criminals, that's going to mean building more prisons. That might be in your area. So he's saying some of this is going to be potentially very unpopular, but he says he's determined to do it.
The government has issued a warning about the dangers of foraging after three people in Jersey were poisoned by mistakenly eating a death cap mushroom. They were treated in hospital, and the BBC understands at least one of them remains there. Sean Combs, the US rapper, also known as P. Diddy, is facing another lawsuit accusing him of rape. The latest allegation comes from a woman who says she was drugged and abused in the hip-hop star's music studio. Emma Vardy reports from LA.
In a tearful press conference in LA, a woman called Talia Graves said she'd suffered years of emotional and psychological trauma from the alleged incident. She says Sean Combs and a colleague of his viciously raped her after allegedly giving her a spiked drink that caused her to briefly lose consciousness. More than 20 years after the alleged attack, Talia Graves says she found out it had been videoed and shown to multiple men. Sean Combs has now been accused by more than 10 women of abuse and assaults. He was arrested in New York City last week and charged with multiple offences. He's currently in prison without bail, awaiting trial.
A Bristol-based university lecturer has successfully grown a full-size ruby in its setting in what's believed to be a world first. Sophie Boones from the University of West of England developed a chemical technique to kickstart the growth process, allowing the gem to multiply. That's the BBC News. It's 3 minutes past 11.
This is all smoke and mirrors. That's sales.
On BBC iPlayer.
What have you got to offer me?
Look, this is in all of our interests, right?
The new series of Industry.
I'm so glad you came.
Starring Kit Harington.
I'm an investment banker. Did you invite me here to watch you eat?
No, I invited you here to seduce you.
I've never met anyone with a bigger blind spot.
All's fair in love and war, right?
I needed my friend and you used me.
Industry.
Now, we go to work.
Starts next Tuesday on BBC iPlayer.
Any excuse to put your toast in the cider is what I'm hearing there, Elizabeth. Are you meant to then consume the toast, or is it just there as
a... Oh, no. Right. It's there for the good spirits, and the good spirits are in the form of the robins, which are meant to then come and eat it.
Even the robins are drunk in Somerset.
That's right.
You're swinging a ball of fire around your head, you know. You set it down just to take a breather. It's still burning quite ferociously, so, you know, it can singe the leg hairs a little bit if you're wearing the kilt.
Brian, Kerry was asking if the straw bears are burned at the end of the ceremony.
Yes, but there's only one simple reason for that. It was just to get rid of the straw. There's nothing magical about it. For goodness sake, don't call it a wicker man. because that really gets me annoyed.
We do one nowadays with based on lamb that's been prepared with garlic and peas and red cabbage and potato and probably cooked in a little bit of red wine, and then that makes the filling, and then the other side we put jam in, so we can call it a lamb and jam one, which has a ring to it.
The absolutely perfect Bedfordshire clanger. But I can see all the people behind the glass looking very hungry in the studio as you talk about the courting cake. I'd love to try it.
We have arranged to drop one off with you.
Tremendous.
Not tonight, though.
Yeah, I think at late night radio I'm allowed to accept that. Maybe it's part of editorial.
It's our gift to you, and it's research, isn't it?
It is, Megan.
Recently, Chowbury Beer Festival has raised the first World Aunt Sally Singles Championship, which technically is a world thing, because, you know, if the Americans can have the World Series, then why can't we have a World Championship for Aunt Sally?
Now, Graham Strachan is from the Newborough Caledonian Lodge of Odd Fellows. Graham, does it go without incident, or do you ever have any dramas when there's hogmanay and Scottish shenanigans involved?
No, it's always a very quiet night, Gordon. I'm sure you'll be aware of your life.
Yes, it's time for Talk of the Town. It's all about where you live and the events and the traditions that make it so special. We love the weird and the wonderful, from cheese rolling to worm charming, from pina colada festivals to celebrating marmalade, from pub games to local food. We'd love to know about it. Get in touch if you have any that you'd like to celebrate. 85058 is the number to text. This week I'm joined by Michaela Hume, who's also a lecturer in public history at the University of Birmingham. And I'm really pleased to say that she joins us now. Hiya, how are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How's your week been so far? I mean, we're fairly new into it. We can include the weekend as well if you've had anything interesting to talk about.
You know what? It's going all right. I started the couch to 5K, you know, the running thing.
Oh, fantastic.
So I did my first 5K on Monday. So I'm feeling very proud of myself. I feel like, you know, I've done it in the Olympics and not literally round the block.
When you say started the couch to 5K, was the 5K your first bit of this? Because you know you meant to finish it. Right, okay. You've done that very quickly, Michaela, if that's the case.
Yeah, very quick. Literally just got in and ran. No, so it. I started a few weeks ago, and this week I'd started it before Christmas and then dropped it. So I was already a bit ahead, you know what I mean? Like I could run a bit. Mm-hmm. So I thought, right, I'm going to pick it back up again. So I picked it back up probably about 3 weeks ago and, ran my first 5K on Monday.
Congratulations.
So, very exciting.
Fantastic stuff. 10K next. And then a marathon by Christmas. That's the way it goes.
We're
going to talk three people, in fact, we'll have on the programme over the next half hour. For Talk of the Town, and there's a definite theme of pyrotechnics and pyro tonight. You're going to give us some more examples of this as we work our way through the half hour, but Michaela, but generally burning stuff. It feels like that's quite a common theme amongst a lot of these festivals and events.
It is, and I think there are kind of two sort of broad reasons why people in the past tended to burn things. So one of them was obviously the obvious, to keep away evil spirits. And in some cases, it was to do with the pagan calendar. So keeping away the evil spirits would then make you have a great harvest. And then you've got the more sinister side, which I think we're going to talk about, you know, where people would burn people at the stake as a form of punishment. So there's two broad reasons, I suppose, why we're obsessed with fire in the past.
I think I know which one I'd prefer to be a part of. We're heading up to the North Pennines first. We'll go to the town of Allendale. This weekend, they're staging the Allen Valleys Folk Festival. But apart from the music, and I dare say the beer, there's a Saturday night event in the town square, which has really caught the imagination. This is the burning of the Allendale Wolf. And I'm joined now by one of the Wolf's designers and builders, Ashley Hipkin. Hi, Ashley. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Yeah, I'm good.
I mean, I'll be amazed if there isn't a folk song called The Burning of the Allendale Wolf, because it's prime for storytelling, right?
I think someone's got to write it.
They have to. Tell me. So tell me firstly, before we get into the full tale of the wolf, how long have you been involved in building and burning wolves?
Well, this is actually our seventh wolf this year. So we started in 2014 as part of the Allen Valleys Folk Festival, which is a music festival held every year for the past 10 years. So they asked us to do something for their festival in 2017. And yeah, three friends, Jonah, Bill and myself, were asked and we built a wolf in our backyard and brought it into the square at night and burnt it the following night.
So was the idea kind of a bit of a marketing thing to get more people to be aware of the festival itself?
I don't think it's a marketing thing. I think you know, it started as a very small music festival and in the church, in the village hall. And I guess there was a sense that there needed to be something that was free and available to everybody in the village. You know, it was more how can we be more inclusive to the people who live in the Allan Valleys? So we've created a kind of focal point. The whole village gathers. It's free. We put on this spectacle for them. Because not everyone can get to the gigs.
So tell us then, the crux of the story, why a wolf?
Yeah. Why a wolf? Well, 1904, a wolf was sighted on the moors around Allendale. And not only sighted, but it started to eat the farmer's sheep. And worry the sheep, terrorize everyone. And lights were lit, animals were brought indoors, search parties were sent out onto the moors. And I think for about 6 months, they tried to capture the wolf unsuccessfully, sadly.
And I mean, at the time, this must have been terrifying for people living that there was a wild wolf roaming the moors.
Yeah. Well, I guess the hope was that it was wild, but I think the last wild wolf was probably in about 1400 in the UK. It turned out that the wolf had escaped from someone's house over in Shotley Bridge, I believe, in County Durham, and had come up probably Weardale and over the top into Allen Heads and the Allen Valley, and made its home there. So, but I guess that sense of wildness, I don't know if you know the North Pennines, it's a pretty wild landscape. You know, it's considered England's last wilderness, and it's pretty harsh and inhospitable up on the top on the fells. So I guess, there was this fear, this animal that was marauding, uncatchable, and but it eventually was found. About 6 months later.
It's kind of, it's got echoes of an American Werewolf in London. I don't know if you've ever seen that film.
Definitely.
But it's sort of Victorian version of it. What happened to him? Because he did meet an untimely end, it seems.
There's a train line between Carlisle and Settle, which is really beautiful. I recommend it. But it was found cut in two pieces by the train track. And so they believe it was hit by the train and came to an end. And then was actually buried by the people who found it, the railway workers. And then they connected it to the story of this wolf further east in the Allan Valleys dug it up and stitched it back together and then presented it to the Hexham Wolf Committee and said, "We think we found your wolf," at which point apparently the guy whose wolf it was denied that it was his. It was to prolong the mystery.
Captain Bane, I believe, who owned
the wolf. Exactly, yes.
I mean, this is such a story. Captain Bane, who had a pet wolf, which escaped.
I think he had more wild animals. I think he had a whole menagerie. But the wolf escaped.
Wolf escaped and marauded across the moors until it met its untimely end and then was exhumed. And then, because they thought, we could make a bit of money out of this, didn't they? They dug it up, and what did they do with it?
Well, they stitched it back together and photographed it, and I think they brought it west. I guess it captured the late Victorian imagination for supernatural as well, and for, you know, the visitation of the werewolf, the vision of him on the moor. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because let me just bring in Michaela here. I mean, we touched on there, capturing the imagination, Michaela, is so important when it comes to these festivals, isn't it? And I'm surprised actually that something like this, you know, a wolf festival hasn't happened before, because this would be prime for something like a local festival to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are similar stories. There's one actually where I go in Wales, in Bedgellit, of a dog. It's slightly different. The dog's heroic. Apparently he saved a child, and that dog is remembered, and people go to the grave and they'll lay flowers down on the dog's grave. So we do have this sort of connection to animals. But there are other festivals around the world where, you know, similar, we focus on the burning rituals that are taking place. There's one in Finland called Johannes, and they don't burn an effigy of an animal. They burn what looks like actually a symbol of the sun, because this is all to do with June, and it's all to do with harvest time, and it's the longest day and people are celebrating. But these things, you know, they are spectacles, and crowds are going because they kind of, I know it sounds terrible, also want to be entertained now, don't they? That's why we have the dancing and the singing. But when they were originally celebrated, you know, the dancing and the singing was often to ward off evil spirits.
Yeah.
Where now it's a bit more of, you know, we get together in communities, which is quite nice, isn't it? Let's be honest, most people don't even know who lives across the road. So the fact that these communities are still putting these events on, I think is brilliant.
Ashley, tell me about the design then, and how you go about actually making it. How big is it? What do you use to make it? How much effort goes into it?
Yeah, well, one of us, Jonah, has a lovely yard full of offcuts of wood. He has a sawmill. So there's a lot of lump wood and bark and bits and bobs lying around. And we basically maybe go to the pub a week in advance and discuss any ideas that we've had. And then we gather the week before. We try and keep the making down to about 2 days. And we often arrive with not a huge idea, but I think it's responding to what materials we've got, the weather, and I think, you know, we started quite modestly. We just built a kind of huge cone with bark on and a small wolf head, and it kind of jetted fire out the mouth as it burnt. And every year we've tried to kind of either be more ambitious, make it bigger, make it fiercer, or relate it to kind of local stories or fairy tales. We've not kind of explored wider political stories or you know, the idea of making an effigy and burning it. It's kind of, we've tried to kind of relate it just to the wolf and just to kind of local history and stories. And yeah, we just have a laugh and we botch it together with bits of offcuts of wood and then cover it in bark and make it as wolf-like as possible. But some might argue it looks like a fox, but but we try our best. And you know, we try and make the mouth move and hope that the fire kind of consumes it in a spectacular way. It is an odd thing. Yeah, it's an odd thing to burn something, you know, because it feels in part that we're celebrating the wildness. Celebrating that aspect of our nature and that aspect of the landscape around us, and the fact that we all live in this landscape. We've all decided to live there. We all survived it. We all, and part of the makeup of the people is this kind of strength and wildness, but then we burn it. So I'm not quite sure why we burn it.
How does it feel? Because you spend ages doing it, and then you just set it on fire. You just watch your work be set on fire and burn in front of your eyes, and then I've just got to do this again next year now, can't we?
Yeah. Well, I think yes, I've got to do it next year. I really look forward to it. But you know, where would we store it if we didn't? But you know, it is great to let go of it and know that next year we've got to reimagine it, and the whole village and whoever comes to the festival has got to reimagine it or what are they going to do this time? You know, what is it? Is it going to be bigger? Is it going to be better? Are we going to prefer 2 years ago, or what story they're going to tell? But I think that whole reinvention of this myth for the younger generation, for all of us, is really exciting, and I'm glad we burn it in a way. It's a relief.
And so. Like you say, it saves on rent in a garage, doesn't it? So
exactly,
cheaper
for you. It'll rot.
There is that paradox, isn't there, Michaela, when you know Ashley talks about this idea that we're sort of celebrating the earth and this idea of, you know, nature, but then burning it to the ground. sort of seems like it doesn't really make sense. And I'm just trying to piece together it maybe is about burning things down so they can build back up again, or is it about reflecting the fragility of life and nature? Because Ashley's right, it does seem a little bit confusing why you would set something on fire to celebrate it.
Yeah, and I can understand where you're coming from. I think, again, it's part of these rituals. Obviously, they've been going back hundreds and hundreds of years, and often it was to get rid of evil spirits and to warn off evil spirits. So, yeah, I can understand where you're coming from. It does seem slightly odd that we burn things down and then celebrate the land upon which we are. But I think a lot of it, as I say, is to do with it's to getting rid of the old and sort of bringing in the new.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that idea of renewal, definitely. Well, it's been lovely to talk to you, Ashley. Have you finished it, by the way? Is it all ready to go and be set on fire?
I'd love to say we have, but no, we're already panicking. But we're halfway. We've built the wolf often comes as part of something else. So right. It's either riding in something or sitting in something. So we've built that bit, but the wolf will happen tomorrow.
Right.
So,
okay. Well, good luck.
I'd like to just also say big shout out to the Tar Barrels event, which happens at New Year in Allendale as well, which would be worth looking at online, which is another fire festival in the same village, in the same square.
How interesting, so, because Tracy in Torquay has just texted me now to say Flaming Tar Barrels, Ottery St Mary. People run through the streets with barrels alight, originated in the 17th century, before the days of health and safety, I guess. fantastic stuff. Yeah, well, have a great one, won't you? And good luck with it, Ashley.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak to you. Bye.
That's Ashley Hipkin there. And as we say, there is definitely a theme of burning on the programme tonight. We're going to head down to Sussex, where it's fair to say that bonfires are a bit of a thing. Instead of saving themselves for November the 5th, they have a fire and fireworks season that's already underway. On Saturday in the village of Buxted will be its first non-Guy Fawkes-related bonfire event since 1979. The chairwoman of the Bonfire Society is Debbie Elliott, and the commander-in-chief is Matt Munnery. Hiya, Matt. How are you?
Hello, I'm all right, yourself?
Yeah, good, thank you, and welcome, Debbie. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So, Debbie, just give us a little bit of a history to this, then. What are these all about? Because it's not related to Guy Fawkes.
Well, it is.
Oh, it is, right, okay.
So, Buxted Bonfire Society originated in 1893. So, many moons ago, the society started, and it closed, unfortunately, we believe, in around 1979-1980. It's been closed for the last 45 years, and we actually reformed the society in 2017 with the mission to bring it back, the tradition of bonfire, back to the village, which is obviously what we're doing. So some of the things that kind of with bonfire, I think Matt's probably the best one to kind of talk about the history of bonfire.
Right, okay. Well, yeah, Matt, you take it over then. So this is related to Guy Fawkes.
Well, yeah, it's related to Guy Fawkes. So I believe it was in January 1606 when they passed an act in Parliament where you had to celebrate the 5th of November every year, and it was repealed in 1859, I believe. And we've in Sussex have basically carried it on. It was in mid 1800s where it all started off in Lewes, which is the bonfire capital of the world, really. It's also to celebrate the 17 martyrs that were burnt at the stake in Sussex, in Lewes, in outside of the pub, which is now the town hall in Lewes. So we also celebrate the people that were burnt at stake for their belief by Queen Mary.
Right. So these are the Protestant martyrs.
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And this isn't just in your village. There's quite a few of these around, as I understand, and you actually have your own uniforms.
Yes, so we all have what are called stripes, which are smugglers, but also each society has their own pioneer costume. So ours is stag warriors and woodsmen to relate to where we come from. So we have a massive deer park in Buxted. So we as Bonfire Society is trying to grab something from where we where the Bonfire Society originates. You know, there's nearly 50 bonfire societies in Sussex.
Right.
So it's, and from the first Saturday in September until the last Saturday in November, We all visit each other's villages and towns, and we celebrate bonfire. We walk through the high streets of their villages and towns with torches, fire torches. We have tar barrels as well, which some have tar barrel races, barrels full of fire, and fireworks, bonfires. It's just a magnificent, magnificent display, and it's just something you never ever see anywhere else.
Is there quite a lot of rivalries, Debbie? Is it who can have the biggest and the best one each week?
No, the bonfire community is phenomenal, and all the societies support each other. There's very much that community feel. You know, our event on Saturday, we're very fortunate that we've got, I think we've got 19 bonfire societies coming along on the night. And we've actually got helpers from a lot of those societies. They will assign a marshal to help you on your night. So there's definitely that real community feel with it. And we all support each other.
Do you have to have toffee apples and jacket potatoes like on the 5th of November?
We don't know. We can do, but no, we don't.
I mean, you'd be the size of a house by the end of the season, wouldn't you, if you're having toffee apples every time? Michaela, it's interesting this, because I think at the crux, and this is exactly what Debbie was talking about, is that celebratory element. You know, no matter where it comes from, the opportunity to bring people together and commune in a way, you know, no matter what's happening in front of you, it's just that sort of group experience that many of these things over the years have probably morphed into.
Yeah, and I've seen the pictures of these events, and can I just say the outfits are fantastic. Honestly, if you're not local, you need to check out some of these bonfire events, because they look brilliant. And I would definitely be there for the toffee apples, let me tell you. I love a good toffee apple. No, and I think that's the thing, you know, we come on every Tuesday and we talk about these amazing things that are happening all over the country. And it really is. It's a celebration of local life. But more than that, it's a celebration of local communities coming together, getting everybody out of the homes and, you know, just keeping these things going. I think it's so important that they keep going and that, you know, that younger generations really do get involved and keep them going, because they're fantastic. Like what you said, it's just bringing people together.
Do you have a lot of interest from the younger people in the community, Debbie, or is it mainly older families involved?
No, most definitely. A huge amount of interest from the younger generation. Our actual youngest member that we have in the society is 15 months old.
Right.
And right through to our oldest member is nearly 80. So there's that huge age range there. You know, all ages, all abilities. Yeah, it's definitely a favourite for anyone kind of within the villages, definitely.
I'm just looking at your outfits now, and they're very impressive, Matt. I've got to say as well, when you look at the pictures, you have this fire, you have the people in the outfits and the uniforms. I don't know what the right word for it. It looks a little intimidating. I don't mean that. I don't mean that in any kind of critical way. I just, do you understand where I'm coming from with this? There is definitely. It looks like something out of quite a scary film. If I'm honest with you.
I mean, you've got people that dress up as Vikings, and if you've ever watched any of the programs, or the dramas with the Vikings, I think it is designed to be intimidating. So,
yeah.
Some of these costumes are so fantastic and so realistic. So much time is put into it. It's such a spectacle. It really is.
Do you make them yourself, the uniforms?
Absolutely, yeah. We go through, we go boot fairs, we go charity shops, we'll go anywhere where we can try and find something that will fit what we make for our costumes. And it's a lot of time and effort goes into making them, and they're usually quite late on, because we're organising our bonfire night. We realise that night to go and walk out on, and we've got no costume hanging.
Right.
We better go and
right.
Modernise it a little bit.
Well, have a great time on the weekend, first of the season. It's going to be a busy old month or so for you. Enjoy it.
And thank you.
Yeah, even though they might not be there every week, enjoy the toffee apples. You've got to have some of them if there's a bonfire. What's the point otherwise? Chairwoman of the Buxted Bonfire Society, Debbie Elliott, and the Commander-in-Chief, Matt Munnery, as well. Thank you very much, guys. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
And Michaela, thanks ever so much for being with us. Have you got any festivals that's coming up over the weekend or the next couple of weeks, by the way?
So it's quite a quiet one for me in terms of festivals. There was a plough championships, ooh, believe it or not. I know. On last weekend, which seemed very good. That was local to me, a ploughing championships. I mean, doesn't get any better than that, does it?
No, that's rock and roll right there. And on that bombshell, Michaela, thank you for being with us. Enjoy the rest of your evening, won't you?
Thank you.
Take care. Michaela Hume there, lecturer in public history at the University of Birmingham. That was Talk of the Towns. Right, just before we get the latest update from Shabnam, let's just throw forward to what's happening after midnight, because it's another Life Less Ordinary. And this week, it's a very special one, as it's life partly is a womble. I've been speaking to Mike Batts, and obviously I had to ask him that burning question. What's it like being a womble?
I'm going to start writing my book, in quotes, you know, because all you mentioned social media. I would sometimes post a funny story about the womble at the traffic lights, you know, and the police stopping and me putting the head on. I've sort of started, so I'll have to finish that one, where I actually put the womble head on coming away from Top of the Pops, thinking that the traffic next car at the red traffic lights would just have a surprise. Yeah. And, of course, I would take the womble head off, which was happened to be on the seat next to me, when I drove off. And it turned out to be a police car. And the policeman turned to me and beckoned for me to wind the window down. And also, I was in a ridiculous bright blue Rolls Royce.
Of course you were.
23 years old.
It was the 70s.
Jack the Lad, you know. And I thought, oh, God, you know. So anyway, I poked my pointed nose out of the posh car, and the policeman in the passenger seat said, OK, Mr. Bat, you've had a little joke. Now, if you just take off the womble head and drive off home carefully, we'll say no more about it. And that was just, you know, one of the lovely things that happens when you're a womble.
Yeah. Imagine seeing Uncle Bulgaria at the traffic lights. More stories like that on the way in the next half an hour. Right now, let's get the update from Shabnam Yunusjewel.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And here is your news and sport. The government has warned that British nationals should leave Lebanon as soon as possible following significant escalation in the fighting between Israel and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Around 700 UK military personnel are being flown to Cyprus as part of contingency plans to support any evacuation. More than 560 people have been killed in 2 days of Israeli airstrikes across Lebanon. Sir Keir Starmer has promised a national renewal in his first speech to the Labour Party conference as Prime Minister, but warned of tough choices ahead. He insisted that keeping a cool head during challenging times would be better in the long term than easy answers. And the government has issued a warning about the dangers of foraging after three people in Jersey were poisoned after mistakenly eating a death cap mushroom. They were treated in hospital, and the BBC understands at least one of them remains there. In sport, all four Premier League teams made it through to the fourth round of the EFL Cup, but Leicester had to squeeze past at League Two Walsall on penalties. They won the shootout 3-0. Chelsea comfortably beat Barrow 5-0 at Stamford Bridge with a hat-trick for Christopher Nkunku. Aston Villa won 2-1 at Wycombe Wanderers, and Manchester City beat Watford 2-1. When asked about Rodri, City manager Pep Guardiola said he'll be out for a long time, but they're still waiting on doctors to confirm the severity of his injury. The midfielder was taken off during City's draw with Arsenal on Sunday. Meanwhile, Wimbledon are still dealing with the flooding of their stadium that postponed their home match against Newcastle to next week at St James's Park. More than 100,000 litres of water has been pumped out of their Plough Lane home, and the League Two club are unsure when they'll be able to stage home games again. And England cricket captain Harry Brook hit a first one-day international century to help them win a rain-affected third match against Australia by 46 runs on the DLS method. The match was abandoned, giving England the much-needed victory to stay in this series. They're now 2-1 down with two matches left to play.
Matt Shawley,
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
He's an addict, so just say the culture media as well.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley, Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Hello, it's Johnny A. Anson here, in for Gordon on a Tuesday evening, 27 minutes to midnight now. And as the year rolls on, those of you more attuned to the changing of the seasons may have noticed we've just passed the autumn equinox, the time of the year when the day and the night are the same length. And if you're lucky enough to have been out for a ramble along the coast in recent days, you may have noticed that low tides have been, well, unusually low, actually. It's coincided with a time when the moon has been closer to us in the northern hemisphere. So what is going on? The very low tides mean we get accompanying very high tides. And when should we expect to see them? That's a question I put to someone who knows everything you could possibly need to know about tides. It's Dr. Joanne Williams, tidal expert at the National Oceanography Centre.
When you get a very low tide, you usually get a very high tide on the same day. So they come as a pair. And what you tend to get is very low tides, very high tides every couple of weeks when the sun and moon align. So when you get around just after a full moon, just after a new moon. And then when you have those full moon or a new moon at the same time as the equinoxes, then everything lines even closer together. And right. That's when you get the really extreme ones.
So just remind us again, if you will, Dr. Williams, the role that the moon plays in this and its gravitational pull on the oceans.
That's right. So the moon obviously is a very heavy body pulling at the Earth and distorting the water on the Earth. And what happens with the tide, so you can think of it as like a wave, a great big slow wave sloshing around the Atlantic twice a day. And then also around the North Sea and around the English Channel, little waves going around those smaller areas. And that wave is pushed and pulled by the gravity of the moon and Earth and sun aligning. We get resonances in different areas. So when those gravitational forces are all aligned the same way, you get a bigger push, a bigger pull on the sea.
So as the moon is moving, it's kind of dragging the ocean with it because of its gravitational pull in a way?
Yes, it's encouraging it to move in a different way as the Earth rotates. Yeah, and then it takes time for the tide to get there. So that's why, you know, you can get very different tide times in different places along the coast. So, you know, if you look at the tide time in Liverpool or you look at it in Cornwall on the same at the same time, the tide will be completely out of phase. But that's because it takes time for the water to respond to that gravitational push.
Fascinating. And obviously the gravitational push and pull then will depend on where the moon is in terms of the hemispheres. So if it's higher up in terms of the northern hemisphere, presumably like it is at the moment, it has a greater push and pull, does it?
Yeah, well, at the moment, with being in the equinox, it's about the same effect between the two. But yes, it can, when things are misaligned, that's when you get different forces in different directions. And from one year to another, the moon can do slightly different things as well. The angle it's at in the sky is a little bit different from one year to another. And so you get changes over a longer cycle as well.
And is it always on a cyclical routine? In a way, then, so it will do exactly the same thing. On is it a monthly, a yearly thing? What is the cycle?
So there are monthly cycles. So from full moon to full moon, new moon to new moon, and then there's also annual cycles, and there's longer ones as well. There's an 18-year cycle, which is quite significant, just from the alignment of the astronomy. But then you also get things that are very hard to predict. So the part that's due to the weather, and we can only predict that a few days in advance with the weather forecast. And that's quite big. I mean, that can be nearly up to a metre is not that unusual.
Right.
To have that sort of size effect around the UK.
And what is it particularly about the weather that would affect it? Is it wind? Is it pressure?
Bit of both.
Right.
So low pressure is really important, and you'll see that as well. You don't get such low pressures around here, but if you see hurricanes in other parts of the world, then the low pressure itself is very significant. The atmosphere is not pushing as hard on the water if the atmospheric pressure is low. And so it literally the sea level rises underneath where the atmosphere isn't pushing as hard.
So the atmosphere is just squashing the ocean down in a way.
Absolutely. Wow. And it's about for every millibar of pressure, you'll see the millibars of pressure on the weather forecast. Yeah. Every millibar is 1 centimetre of sea level.
Really? Is that right? So presumably then that will, though, does that displace elsewhere? So will that cause a higher tide elsewhere? So it'll just kind of like a tube of toothpaste.
Spread out over a wide area. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. And then
the wind as well.
Yeah. And so the wind will push it towards the shore or push it away then in a kind of basic idiot's way of explaining
more or less
it. I like the way you're humoring me there. Feel free to say no, you're completely wrong on that one, Johnny.
Well, if it was quite that easy, we wouldn't have to run models to sort it out. It's a little bit more
if only people listening could have seen your face. Yeah, sort of like that. Not really. You mentioned weather. Climate is obviously incredibly important. We've seen these really low-level tides at the moment. The Met Office, a couple of years ago, I think it was, said that because sea levels are rising much faster, we may start to lose these really low tides. Just tell us a bit more about that and how concerned you are at the impact that climate change is having on our tides.
Yeah, so sea level, we're expecting rises of the order of about a metre over the next century, that sort of size. And so what we see is that the very low tides that we reached last week, you know, that sort of thing will happen less and less frequently as you add on that extra sea level rise. And then, of course, the high tides will happen more and more frequently, and the flooding associated with high tides as well. We'll get that more and more often.
Yeah, and that is the very real impact of climate change, isn't it? And this is more than just, oh, the water will be a couple of metres more upon the beach. It can have a devastating effect on the coastal line, coastal erosions, and, of course, communities and the wildlife that live near it.
That's right, yeah. So, you know, as around the UK, because we have such a large tidal range, most places won't find themselves flooded all the time because of this, but they'll be flooded more often and the salt will get further inland and, as you're saying, got greater erosion as well.
That's Dr. Joanne Williams, tidal expert at the National Oceanography Centre. It's Johnny in for Gordon, 20 to midnight. And just a heads up, if you're in the north of England and listen to 5 Live on 9:09 a.m, there's going to be some essential engineering work done on one of our transmitters tonight, just after midnight, as it was last night, actually. So to stay with 5 Live, you can find us on DAB Digital Radio. We'll be on the telly as well, on digital TV, and, of course, on BBC Sound. So that's that essential transmitter work that's being undertaken just after midnight tonight. Now, the US is planning to ban certain hardware and software made in China and Russia from cars, trucks and buses in America because of safety risks and security issues. Officials are worried the tech could allow enemies to remotely manipulate cars on American roads. Ariane Marshall has been covering the story for Wired magazine and joins us now. Good evening to you.
Good evening.
So just how much of an issue is this? Explain the background to it, if you will.
Yeah, this is definitely more of a preemptive move on the Biden administration, the U.S. government is taking right now, and really the last of a series of pretty anti-Chinese EV actions that the U.S. government has taken, both to protect national security and, of course, to protect the domestic U.S. car market, which is so important in the United States. Just last May, the Biden administration announced it was going to be hiking tariffs against Chinese EVs, as well as some materials that go into those electric vehicles by 100%. So really high tariffs. And now we have this news that the administration has proposed this new rule that would ban Chinese and Russian automotive hardware and software from the U.S., making it even harder for those cars to come into the U.S.
And what's the fear, Ariane, that they could remotely crash the cars or they could spy on people in them?
Yeah, the government says the fears are twofold. First, they don't want foreign governments collecting data on U.S. drivers and infrastructure. And then, yes, also these fears about foreign adversaries really taking over vehicles. We've talked to some experts at Wired who think this isn't necessarily something that's a fear immediately. I actually asked the U.S. government yesterday if this is something U.S. drivers should be worried about right now. They said no. Sounds like something they want to take care of before it's really a problem.
Right, yeah, because the ban isn't coming in until 2027, as I understand it. So I guess there's a question, what about all the cars that are on the road now with this technology in it?
Yeah, that's right. And again, the government said that U.S. drivers have no reason to be afraid right now, though we have at Wired been reporting for a number of years on researchers, white hat hackers who have been successful in taking over the controls of vehicles, which are increasingly so connected with the internet, so sophisticated in terms of their technology. But of course, that comes with cybersecurity downsides.
What's the honest feeling amongst the industry in the States, Ariane? Is it that there is a real risk or perhaps that this is more politically motivated?
Yeah, what we heard from industry yesterday once this proposed rule came out was the car industry seems pretty happy about this. Of course, you can ask whether that's about real legitimate security concerns or fears that they're really going to get their, you know, butts handed to them by the Chinese automakers who have been so successful in making cheap, good electric vehicles. What they've said, industry said yesterday, is that they're pretty pleased with the timeline that the U.S. government has proposed in these rules, and that they believe that they have enough time to get what few Chinese and Russian hardware and software that exists right now in the supply chain out of the supply chain by the time this rule would kick in 2026, 2027.
Have we heard from China or Russia on this?
I have not heard from China or Russia on this, but it'll be very interesting to see what those countries, and particularly China, do in response. Of course, the American electric vehicle company Tesla is pretty successful in China and has done a pretty good job cooperating with the Chinese government to make sure that it can sell its electric vehicles there. It will be interesting to see if China decides to retaliate in any way.
Okay, Ariane, thank you for your time. Take care.
Thanks.
That's Ariane Marshall there, who's been covering the story for Wired magazine. Now, this is a fascinating story, particularly if you've ever watched the documentary on Netflix, My Friend the Octopus Teacher, because it's astonishing. Octopuses have been caught on camera teaming up with fish to trap prey. The researchers have also found that the usually solitary creatures can turn on their co-hunters, even punching fish in the group to make them work harder. Professor Jacqueline McGlade is a marine biologist and expert in dynamics of ecosystems from the University College London, and I had a chat with her a little earlier.
It's not a new phenomenon. In fact, I observed it myself in the late 90s when I was on the Chagos Islands on an expedition. And I just saw it. I didn't record it, but I realized that these things were going on all around me. But what this paper has done is it kind of filmed it, and I think has really brought it out that there are different kinds of battles going on all the time, but sometimes animals do get together in very unusual combinations. And that's what this brings home, I think.
Octopuses. Is it octopuses or octopi? That should have been my first question.
I always say octopuses, but right. I bet you there's a purist that says octopi.
Or cephalopods.
Cephalopods is easier. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's easier to say than octopus, but I'm going to go with octopuses because you're the expert, Professor. Octopuses, as I understand it, generally are solitary animals. So
exactly.
How surprising was it for you not just to see them in groups, but actually in groups with other fish rather than just octopus?
Well, I think let's tackle the first thing. I mean, they're very reclusive. They're usually solitary. And so what I observed, and I think what others had in the same place in the tropics and so on, are individual octopuses coming out, and essentially they are waiting predators. So they'll hide themselves, and therefore when prey go by, you know, they bang out. So when they have come out in this on individual, like with a big group of fish, they are like true hunters. And what I was surprised about was how they orchestrate themselves at either end with a sort of group of pushing fish through under a boulder and the octopus on the other side. Now, I don't know who gets the more fish out of this procedure. One assumes it probably is the octopus. But the extra piece of the puzzle here is when you see groups of octopuses coming together. But it doesn't seem to be so direct in terms of a hunting strategy, which makes people think that this is them scavenging more because right. They're hungry and there's less food around. So it's not a normal behavior, to be quite honest.
But the idea that octopuses would be working with other fish, and as you say, I think you've seen it with groupers, for instance, is extraordinary. I mean, first and foremost, how are they arranging this? How are they communicating to get together in the first place to go on these hunts, do you think?
I'm convinced, having spent a lot of time underwater as a diver, that there's enormous communications going on all the time amongst fish, octopuses, dolphins, you know, all of the marine life that's there. They're not separate from each other. So, of course, when you look at it as a scientist, you think, well, they're miles apart in gene terms. But actually, they're living in close proximity. So they're highly aware of each other. And I suspect that if two predators are hungry and they don't really fancy eating each other, then it makes a lot of sense to go after things together. So I'm not surprised. I saw it myself. I didn't make it sort of as a remarkable piece of natural history. But I suspect that if you sat and watched a coral reef, you would see this all over the place.
Well, I guess it makes sense, does it? This huge organism, which is effectively a massive community. Like any community of people living together, there'll be those that get on with each other, those that don't. There will be collaboration. There'll be individualism. Why would it be any different in the aquatic world?
Yes, and we see it on land. I mean, we see the oddest combinations of animals going about their business and hunting together and so forth. So, yes, we shouldn't be surprised. But on the other hand, it is worth understanding what the communication might be between them. So we know, I often say an octopus is just a brain, the brain is in its arms. And so effectively, it's out there sensing the environment as it's sweeping through the water. So you can imagine that they're sensing these bigger fish and others. So they'll see a hunter, a fish like a grouper, and really be able to maximize the use of that for its own purposes.
The other interesting aspect to this is it seems that some of the octopuses get quite angry with those that aren't pulling their weight or doing the right thing and have been seen punching some of the fish.
I actually found that really funny. I mean, it's just such an anthropomorphic thing. Like, could you just be more competent? Could you actually do the job? And so that's why I think it's so intriguing as to what is going on. And we do know that octopuses can play puzzles. They can go in mazes. They can do all kinds of things. You know, they can be rewarded. They can be punished, and they respond in likewise. So maybe they're chuckling all the way around the coral reefs, these octopuses.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, it's a Pixar or a Disney film, isn't it? That's what we're watching there. It seems from this research that the fish were not observed, though, at any point ramming the octopus. It was the octopus that was doing the corralling and the bullying, which would that suggest they are the top of the hierarchy in this situation? Is that something which resonates with your experience of watching them?
I absolutely convinced that octopuses have a sense, a much greater three-dimensional space sense, that they are able, because they're very flexible, of course, in the body terms. They're not restricted through having a skeleton. So they're able to push their way through spaces. So I suspect that their three-dimensional understanding of the world is much greater than fishes. And as a result, they're probably able to really have a much greater understanding of what the medium is that the fish are swimming in.
Yeah.
So for that reason, I would say they're more intelligent, but they've got more neurons firing,
right,
which is giving them a much greater sense of awareness.
What do you, from your experience, and this though, thinks it tells us about their sentience, their consciousness in a way? I'm sure you've seen My Octopus Teacher on Netflix. Mm. And many people listening will have as well, and couldn't be anything but astonished by what was happening there. And the premise, for those that haven't seen it, is effectively this filmmaker, Craig Foster, goes free diving and becomes friends with an octopus who ends up kind of giving him gifts and forming a genuine relationship, it seems, with them. So I take it you would not be surprised. I mean, do you think these fish are, and octopus especially, are sentient? They have that sense of consciousness?
I don't think you'd call it consciousness, but in the same way, for example, that birds befriend adult humans and bring them gifts, you can see that living beings, whatever form they come in, can create these bridges, which I think are, maybe you'd call them consciousness of each other, but it's certainly the case that presumably their electrons, their sentience around each other has some resonance, which means that they are attracted. So I don't know whether it's a conscious thing, but I would certainly say there's an attractor that's going on there. And that's probably what we're seeing even between the octopus and the fish.
Fascinating conversation. Professor Jacqueline McGlade there, marine biologist and expert in dynamics of ecosystems from the University College London. And if you haven't watched that documentary, honestly, I urge you, go and watch it because it is absolutely fascinating. Right, 7 minutes to midnight. And have you ever wanted to get your hands on a whopping great ruby? Well, did you know that you're able to actually grow rubies in a lab? The technology of growing rubies is not new, actually, but a university lecturer in Bristol has managed to develop a new process of growing them in situ, placed in metal structures like rings, and she's hoping that will transform the jewellery industry and attitudes towards gemstones made in labs. Sophie Boones is the woman behind it, the researcher at Centre of Print Research and senior lecturer in design crafts at the University of West of England. Hi, Sophie, how are you?
Hello, good evening.
Tell me then about growing rubies. How do you do it?
Yeah, the process I use to grow rubies in situ in Jewry is actually rather simple. So all I need is a furnace of up to 1,200 degrees, a platinum crucible, so something that is going to contain the chemicals that you then need to grow rubies. And I then create a platinum piece of jewelry and place a seed, which I create from ruby waste materials that I found in industry or in the gemstone trade. And I add the chemicals, so aluminium oxide, which is what rubies are made of, and a small percentage of chromium. That's what gives rubies their color, and a flux to lower the temperature of the mixture. And this filled crucible is then heated for anything between 5 to 50 hours. I'm currently experimenting with the time. The time really sort of changes how clean the ruby is. So we'll get to the stage where it's the right amount of time. And, right. And yeah, that's basically how it's done.
Don't you need a huge amount of pressure as well, though, to create gemstones?
No, that's a preconception. Right. All gemstones require huge amounts of pressure. So ruby actually is quite happy to grow in a furnace without, well, just normal room pressure.
Oh, interesting. So what is the advantage? I mean, is there any difference chemically or structurally or anything? If I was a gemstone expert and I was looking at one dug out of the ground and one that you've grown, would I see a difference? Would I notice a difference?
Well, any lab-grown ruby is identical to the rubies found in the earth. So mined gemstones are the same as those lab-grown ones. And I would say that you could potentially see a difference, but depending on the processes that were used, there might be more faults in the crystal structure that could tell you that there might have been a certain process used. But they are chemically identical, right, and therefore there shouldn't be a distinction between them.
How has it been received in the jewellery industry? I imagine some people are a little bit unhappy about this, aren't they?
Well, so as you said, the growth of rubies, we've been able to do that for over 100 years. So this is not a new technology by any means. I think we've been less long able to 3D print. So the jewelry industry has responded in the beginning, particularly quite negatively. So my PhD research has looked into this, of course, because there is a lot of commerce of mined gemstones, and people were worried that the price of rubies was going to drop. But I think what we have to do today is not necessarily look at what is financially most interesting. I think we need to think about what is sustainable and what we can do to reduce our impact on the environment. So with lab-grown gems as well, when you grow them from scratch without using a seed or a large enough seed, you're using quite a bit of energy, for example.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to propose here is that we look at waste and we start to use that waste as seeds and therefore reduce the time that you need to grow something larger. And because I expect that the jewelry industry isn't going to be so very excited about these technologies being revived again, I'm also trying to convince the jewelry field and the general public that some of these technologies have incredible opportunity for innovation.
Yeah.
So growing in situ is definitely something that's never been done before, and that's now possible because we're able to lower the temperature of the recipe.
Okay, fascinating stuff. Sophie, thanks ever so much. Good luck with it, and I'll get in touch with you around Christmas when it's time to get presents for people.
Thank you.
All right. See you later. Sophie Boone's there behind this new approach in growing gemstones, rubies specifically. Right. We're here till 1 a.m. and then it's the Night Watchman. It's Dotton. Hiya, Dotton. How are you?
I'm very well, Johnny. A very skillful, if I might say so, interview about the octopus's garden. And I see how you very eloquently navigated your way around Madison Square Garden, the octopus's Madison Square Garden, to leave Anthony Joshua out of it.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Out of boxing the Shirker workers. I thought you were really, really good. I'm serious.
But thank
you. I was like, go on, Johnny, go on.
I don't know whether
Bring in Madison. Madison Square Garden.
I don't know whether to believe you or not, Dotton, but I'll take it as a compliment.
It was a compliment, genuinely. No, it was a great story. I mean, you can't beat that, can you? Octopuses are smarter than we are. Some others have said, and the lady knew everything about them. So
it was great, yeah.
Yeah.
What's on the show tonight, then?
Well, we would talk about the Labour Party conference in general, Sir Keir Starmer's speech, but we want to talk specifically about the suggestion that the government are considering shutting pubs down earlier for the sake of the nation's health, because some 40% or so of the NHS's resources go to treating avoidable health conditions, let's put it that way. And the government has highlighted alcohol, I suppose, is amongst them. The question is, should the government be legislating about our private social lives and how we navigate our own cultural landscape? And also, we're asking not only about the first car you owned, but the first car that you would rather have owned, if you see what I mean. So what was your first car? What was the first car that you really wanted?
A Red Rover Metro. It cost me £400, bought from a bloke on the outskirts of Leeds. And I'll be honest, I wouldn't have changed it for the world, Dot. And it had a choke. Do you remember a choke?
Of course, a choke. I do remember a choke. I'm still choking from jokes.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Justine Green. The government has told British nationals that they should leave Lebanon as soon as possible because of the significant escalation in fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. The UK is sending additional troops to Cyprus as part of contingency plans to evacuate British people from Lebanon. Health officials there say more than 560 people have been killed in the past 48 hours. Israel said it hit hundreds of Hezbollah sites, accusing the militant group of hiding weapons in residential areas. Well, Chris Du is a journalist working for The Guardian in Beirut.
We've been seeing sites of mass bombing all over the country. We've been seeing it in Beirut itself, and we've been seeing the results of it. I mean, I went and I visited displacement centers around the city. The sites there are pretty grim, and just the streets of the city are filled with people who are just looking for a place to stay right now.
Sir Keir Starmer has warned of trade-offs in order to reform areas such as housing and energy in his first Labour conference speech as Prime Minister. Addressing delegates in Liverpool, he said he would resist easy answers to tough challenges, but said that there was light at the end of the tunnel. Our political correspondent Helen Catt says the party has shifted the tone.
If you think back a few weeks to Keir Starmer and his Rose Garden speech, and, you know, things will get worse was the message. The language around all of that was very bleak. And so certainly at this conference, we have seen a little bit of a change of tone. So you've still got a bit of that doom and gloom in there, but there is this repeated sense of things are happening, a change is beginning.
Several people have been arrested in Switzerland after a controversial assisted suicide device was used for the first time. The pod, named Sarko, allows people to kill themselves without the aid of a medic. It was used to end a woman's life in a hut in a forest in the north of the country. Officials said it breached Switzerland's laws allowing assisted suicide. The cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike has issued a new apology for the global disruption caused by one of its system updates in July. The incident led to global flight cancellations, as well as hitting banks, healthcare and media companies. A senior vice president at the company, Adam Myers, told a US congressional committee that the same mistakes wouldn't be repeated.
CrowdStrike was in the process.